good to see you again. Some people will maybe be coming in as we are doing some meditation. So let's begin with a little motivation. And as we progress, we'll do a little meditation on emptiness. Before we just finished mainly with the clear light nature of the mind, and then we went to develop the motivation within that quietness. This time from the clear light mind, we'll try to recognize or identify the object of negation of personal selflessness or emptiness of the self. Sometimes we say selflessness has two divisions, selflessness of persons and selflessness of phenomena. And in the Mahayana, that's synonymous with emptiness of persons and emptiness of phenomena. And even within emptiness or selflessness or emptiness of persons, there are two varieties. Emptiness of persons in general and or selflessness of persons in general, and the selflessness or emptiness of your own personal identity, how the I seems to be appearing. So we will try to recognize that and use some reasonings. So sit comfortably. Can you all hear me okay? Am I loud enough? Okay. I'm going to take a sip of water first. Dalai Lama always has. Yesterday I had a Pepsi. I decided that wasn't a good idea afterwards. I have hot water again. The Dalai Lama usually just has hot water when the other Tibetans have Tibetan tea. Excuse me. Okay. Sit comfortably. Relax your body. Relax your mind. And as a prelude, see if you can be very, very strict and watch the entire cycle of at least 7 respirations, counting them. So your mind has one more object to pay attention to. Like, this is the first inhalation. This is the first exhalation. It's just changing. Now it's second inhalation, like that. Now, upon the next inhalation, imagine breathing up the two nostrils as though it goes up to the crown of your head, down to your heart chakra area. Leave your attention there and just watch your mental consciousness. As we mentioned yesterday, in emptiness, there's no color or shape. Also, in the clear light nature of the mind, there's no color or shape. So here, as you're watching the mind, first of all, when you're trying to get an idea of the clear light nature, it's not lightness that's coming into your eyes or blackness. Just an understanding through your wisdom, you might say the wisdom eye, that the consciousness is unobstructing to the arisal and to the dismissal, you could say, or evaporation of thoughts back into the mind. In that way, it's like space, in that it lacks any obstruction to the various kinds of thoughts. Training yourself to let go of the thoughts once they arise. Don't follow them. Watch the space between them and try to hold that. As you hold that, the other thoughts have less energy to propagate, to endure, because you're depriving them of attention. As we said before, the mental consciousness knows what is being presented itself to the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and tactile consciousnesses. So there may be, even in your mental consciousness, there may be an awareness of those. Recognize them as arising within the spaciousness of the mind. Let them fade away and focus on the spaciousness of the mind within which they're arising. The sense of the body. When we did this earlier, I said at this point often, even the sense of I, the meditator, the observer, let go of. Here, try to cultivate that. Not in the sense of, remember some of the questions yesterday and the day before about imagining I as having certain qualities, thinking and doing things and so forth. Not that. But just the sense of an autonomous, inherently existing I. If you can bring to mind some dynamic situation when you've been criticized or hurt, when you've gotten angry, someone's accused you unjustly, when you're desperately in love, just the sense of, not the sense of indignation or the attachment, but the behind there seems to be a sense of I. It's very elusive and very subtle. So one needs time to be patient and watch for it. This subtle object of negation, we call it, because although it's appearing, it's negated in the sense that the object that we imagine it to be doesn't exist. In the same way that we say we can negate the reality of a reflection in a mirror, it doesn't mean that the reflection doesn't appear, but that we understand it as lacking a reality of its own, from its own side. It's actually the reflection of our face. If you've been upset about politics lately or some personal event in your life, bring back that situation in the laboratory of your mind. We'll now be able to use that, what seemed like adverse condition, to recognize the I, the object of negation. The I does not seem to be dependent on the body and mind. It seems to have an existence all by itself. In grosser versions of this I, it seems to be the owner of the body and mind, the controller or the experiencer of the body and mind. But here we're looking at something even more subtle, the sense of the I as just existing in reality, say truly existing or inherently existing from its own side. Because anger is a more obvious energetic mind than some of the others, often to bring to mind some situation that rose your indignation or your anger, is more efficient to see the I than thinking of attachment or jealousy or other things, but they can also be very dynamic. If you get a sense of that I, try to recognize with your mind how it's appearing. Seems to be just there by itself, existing from its own side. And another aspect of your mind investigating how your mental consciousness reacts to that appearance. It's not just indifferent. If you've actually found the object of negation, there's a part of the mind that is perceiving it, that is assenting to that appearance as though, oh, that's there. That's how it is. That's me. I'm real. The appearance of the object of negation will disappear when we have an understanding, a realization of it's not the non-existent of the referent object here, that what it's referring to, when we have an understanding of its emptiness. But in general, it will remain until we become a Buddha. Only time it disappears completely is when we're in meditative equipoise on emptiness, the appearance of the eye. But the part of the mind that's grasping to it, that's assenting to its appearance, it's going along with it. Not necessarily in words that say, oh yes, that's me, that's real, but implicitly understanding that it's there and going along with it. That's the ignorance that is grasping to the self-identity, to the inherent existent I. The appearance is not the main problem, but that appearance instigates the ignorance that grasps to it as real and acts as a condition for all of the other delusions, all the other klesha to rise. Well, it even gives rise to virtuous states of mind, contaminated states of mind, contaminated by ego grasping, that help us create virtuous karma, but that karma, unless skillfully dedicated, will just ripen in cyclic existence. That's why it's called contaminated in one sense. The appearance of this I seems to be referring to something, as though there is something there. Not just like a reflection or an echo once we've understood it to be devoid of the reality that others might mistake it for or dream. We're like in that dream state where the dogs chasing after us seem so real and we're believing them. If this I actually existed the way that it appears, it would have to be findable, because it appears to be findable. It seems to have an existence from its own side, as though you could analyze and find it somewhere. one famous logic to help to refute this is to understand that if two things exist, they either have to be the same or different. Think about that for a second. You have something underneath a napkin, might be a glass or a cup or something standing up, and you're wondering whether it is a cup. If that underneath the shroud or the napkin hold above it is actually a cup, it would be one with cup. If it's not a cup, it's different than cup. There's no third position. If two things exist, they either have to be identical or different. So here we take the two things we're going to check is this I that we're imagining to exist, that we've tried to recognize, and our aggregates, which we've come to understand through the teachings of Buddha, are the basis upon which we recognize an I, myself. If this object that's appearing to our mind really existed the way that it appears, it would have to be findable as identical with the aggregates, the five aggregates, or totally different from them. They either have to be the same or different. If they're different in any way, two things are different in any way, they're different. They're not identical. If this I that's appearing to the mind were identical to the aggregates, very simply, because there are five aggregates, there would have to be five I's. Five different egos, identities that we identified with each of the five aggregates. Because we know that leaving out any of the aggregates, there's not a sufficient identification of a person. If a person doesn't have consciousness or body, if they don't have feeling or discrimination or compositional factors, they don't have all of them, it's not a person. They always come as a package. So with it, using that absurd consequence that if the I were identical to the aggregates, there would have to be five I's, and there are certainly not, you can come to the conclusion that the I is not one with the aggregates. It's not identical with them, not inherently one with them. The other option is that if it existed, if the I, we consider the pair I and the five aggregates, if they're not the same, they would have to be different. Let me preface the original statement. If two things exist, they either have to be the same or different. So if the I that we're imagining to be behind the image, it's something actually there. If it exists, it either has to be the same as the aggregates or different than the aggregates. It's not the same as the aggregates because there are five aggregates. And it's not findable separate from the aggregates, different than the aggregates. There are no instances of our sense of I that's not related to this combination of five heaps, five aggregates, five skanzas. Well, first of all, it would have to be separate from the mind, because the consciousness is one of the five aggregates, the primary consciousness, and the other feeling, discrimination, and compositional factors, the other mental factors, that I would have to exist somehow different than them. Not just different in general, but inherently different, not relying on them in any way. Would have to be independent of the body, so that if you were stung or hurt your knee or had a headache, you wouldn't think, my body hurts or my head hurts. It would be completely independent of the five aggregates. So if two things exist, they have to be the same or different. If this appearance of the self represented an inherently existent self, it would have to be inherently one with the aggregates or inherently different from the aggregates. We've searched both possibilities. Both of them are unreasonable, untenable. They give rise to absurd consequences. So keeping in mind, if it existed, it would have to be identical to the aggregates, which are five in number, or different than the aggregates, unrelated to them. And we know the sense of I could not be separate from the aggregates, and it would absurdly be a multiple personality at one time, having five kinds of eyes if it were one with the aggregates. Therefore, the I that we're imagining doesn't exist at all. Like the reality of another person in a mirror that we see out of the corner of our eye in a glass door. We see our own reflection and we think, oh, there's another person there. We turn, and at that point we recognize there's no person there at all. It's devoid of other person. Or like the reality of something frightful or desirous in a dream, when we wake from that, we realize it didn't exist at all. It was just an appearance. It didn't exist the way that we had apprehended it in the dream. At that point, your wisdom recognizes simply the lack of what we were previously grasping to, the existence of an inherently existent I. all that appears to the mind is that understanding, its lack. In a sense, it's like a vacuity. Nothing appears to the mind other than that vacuity. So we sometimes call it space-like meditation on emptiness. At this point, you're not thinking the I doesn't exist. There's just the appearance of that vacuity that has been impelled by that understanding, by that logic. Apprehension of emptiness of the self. When you arise from that concentration, it may not last for more than an instant anyway, the I may appear again, whereas in the period of apprehending as emptiness, nothing else appeared, like the Heart Sutra said, in emptiness there is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. Now it appears, but you recognize it like an illusion, like a dream, like an echo, like a reflection, like the appearance of the form, the shape of a moon, of the moon, in a pond of water in front of you. You glance down and you see the moon, and you immediately know that it's devoid of being the actual moon that's up in the sky. It appears so real and clear in a puddle of water or even a glass of water. But you know it is like an illusion, like a reflection. So within that state of illusion-like recognition of emptiness as Avalokiteshvara was in when he was explaining to Shariputra, still with that memory of emptiness, so that everything has a kind of rainbow-like appearance, in the sense that there is an understanding in the mind that they are appearing but not really existing the way that they appear. Recognize that this illusion-like I is going to participate in an illusion-like listening to the rest of the talk about, rest of the discourse about the Heart Sutra. Think that I'm going to do so in order to accumulate illusion-like merit, which still functions because the law of cause and effect and emptiness do not contradict one another. They actually reaffirm one another. If phenomena were inherently existent, they couldn't change. There couldn't be a cause followed by an effect. I'm going to listen to accumulate merit in order to make increase of my realizations, which we saw yesterday. There's no inherently existent increase or decrease or fulfillment and so forth. in order to achieve enlightenment that can't be found anywhere, that doesn't inherently exist, but still functions for the welfare of all sentient beings who are laboring under this ignorance, grasping to a self of persons, a self of phenomena, and are therefore entrapped in cyclic existence. I'm going to participate, listen, contemplate, meditate in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. And then bring your attention back to present. This illusion-like body looks a little bit cleaner today. I took a shower. When I was looking yesterday, I realized I looked a bit raggy around the edges. So, how was that? I would be totally amazed if anyone realized emptiness. I don't know, I'd be pleasantly surprised, but did anyone have any kind of different insight than you've had before in that? Or you have any questions about what we've just talked about?
I feel like, this is Barb, I feel like I have a glimmer.
Oh, good. Like a glowworm, huh?
Well, like a hint of it. And it's like I get hold of it, and I try to read about it, more about it overnight. Probably didn't get as much sleep as I should have. But I feel like I need to keep on pursuing it, or I'll lose it totally.
Yeah, so that's a good observation that Lama Zopa Rinpoche has mentioned many times. Yogis and yoginis, when they're practicing the various practices in the path, even tantric things like Tummo and so forth, you have to have a continuity of that. And once you've had a little insight, don't think, okay, I can leave that now. It's like the example of starting a fire with two sticks of wood, right? Have you ever done that? I tried when I was teaching Lama Ussel at Sarah. I tried to do that, and I failed. So you have, if you start rubbing the sticks together, you start to they start to develop, because of the friction, they start to develop some warmth. If you think, oh, I'm gonna take a break, you know, you have your cup of tea or hot water or something, and then you go back to rubbing the sticks, they will have cooled in the interim, and you almost have to start from scratch, especially if you wait too long. So if you have a little glimmer of realizations, it's important to try to bring them to, you know, full fire, full realization.
Sharpen the focus.
Pardon?
Sharpen the focus.
Continue what you're doing. You read between sessions, meditate again, hear other talks, weigh it in your mind, discuss with Julie and Hemant and Patpati and Karen and Donna and Diana, you know, discuss with your Dharma buddies. Robbie's a good debating partner. And that, it causes you to look at things differently. It's like in the debating courtyard. Sometimes people wonder why that's such an important part of the education of the monks and nuns in Tibetan Buddhism. Not everyone debates, but that's a famous tradition. And it's, in a sense, a way of meditating, because you're, rather than one part of your mind trying to look at something from a new direction so that you get a clearer understanding of it. You're forced to look at it from another point of view because someone else, their point of view is different. They're looking at it from this point of view. You're looking at it from this point of view. And then you have to put your mind over here and try to understand that. And if they're wrong, you have the ethical obligation of helping them, trying to remove their wrong understanding. You may think you have the right understanding. They have the right understanding. So when you debate with them, you'll lose if they're a skillful debater. And that's to your benefit also in the debating courtyard. Okay.
Discussion is a big part of learning anything.
Yeah, it can be discussion with yourself, like Milarepa or other people that are in isolation. They have to depend just on their own mind and the teachings they remember and so forth. But if you have if you have access to your spiritual friends, that's better, obviously. So anyone else have a thought, have an observation?
Can I ask another question? I don't want to dominate.
Of course.
I have so many questions. So I always get confused during this sort of search for the I, because maybe the idea I have is wrong, but the idea I have is that there's not nothing. There is something there. It's not nihilistic. It's not that I don't exist at all.
Right.
And I think that that something that exists, I think in Buddhism, they call it the Buddha nature. In the Christian tradition, you call it like the Christ inside you or the holiness inside you or your own divinity. I don't know.
Maybe not. Okay.
Well, I don't know. This is what I'm asking. And so I think when I hear you say the thing that is inherently existing, I think it's that. I think the inherently existing thing must be the thing that really is there. And that that there's a false I layered on top, sort of like if in a play or something and I put on a costume, that's the false thing. But there really is something there. It's not nothing at all.
No. That's not right.
Okay. Help me out.
If I say no three times, then you have to say, oh, wait a second. Let me listen to what it's saying. So the way things are there in reality is almost inexpressible. I once asked the Dalai Lama, Jeffrey Hopkins was translating, it was a big group in Dharamsala, and he had given a little talk about emptiness, how you can't find a table in any of its parts, yet the table doesn't exist other than the parts. You know, like, for instance, the parts of the table are there. They're made into a table. We say that the parts are properly assembled, right? Like IKEA? not just the kit. Now it's assembled there. But you might say, okay, the table doesn't exist in the parts. I've looked at all the parts. I can't find what I imagine is table. Like, remember we investigated your, what was it, your MGB, not MGB, was it your... what's your car?
The car was the BMW.
BMW, three letters. I was going to say IBM, BMW. You can't, it's not the medallion, it's not this, it's simply a name that we attribute to that.
Right.
So the table is not different than the parts. You know, you might think, okay, I know the table. I can't find the table in the parts. Therefore, it must be separate. There's some tableness that exists that is not, there in the parts, not congruent with them. That doesn't exist either. The same way that if you look for the sense of I, when you were saying maybe the Christ inside, the example I gave before was a Christian. A theologian, someone I hope will look it up, research it sometime so I can find the quotation I could use in the future. He said that there's no need to prove the existence of the soul, the eternal soul, because it's when you pray, when you're there, your mind is quiet. It's so apparent, you know, like without doubt. That's the object of negation. Because the word for soul in Sanskrit is atma. Do you know that? The word atma. A-T-M-A.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddha's insight was into anatma. A-N-A-N-T-A. An, for a word that begins with A, like atma, instead of adding an A before it to negate it, remember I said yesterday the shortest prajnaparamita was a prajnaparamita in one syllable, the syllable a, which means like un or no or not. So in the case the word begins with a vowel, you use an before it instead of a. So anatma means no self, selfless. And so that is a radical difference from other spiritual traditions. The Buddha was saying, not only is there no self of the person, the word self also, you could say the self of the table. You say, oh, come on, a table is not a self, but it has a self-identity that we imagine is really there. So when you talk about what's really there, there's nothing that's really there. What appears to your mind due to karma in the past, having been born as a human, you have an appearance of your body and mind that you recognize, you know your feelings, your discriminations, your other emotions in the compositional factor aggregate, you know your bare consciousness, you have an apprehension of your body. They all seem to have a real existence. And on the basis of that, you have a kind of pride of being I, you know, I, Karen, you know, I, Robbie, I, Julie, whatever. That I is also an appearance to your mind that's due to karma and due to karma. The appearance is due to past karma and because of familiarization in over numberless lifetimes in the past with believing those appearances to be real. It's like we've been in a dream for innumerable eons. And we've just believed all, you know, we've always been believing in these dreams as real. If you were to awaken from that, you would see all those things that you thought were real were actually, they appeared. They definitely appeared, right? You remember the dreams. And I went down that lane, the dogs chased me, and then I met a handsome man, and we had children, they died, all these stories. But they were all empty of existing in reality. Like that, all of the things that we experience have a similar kind of consistency as a dream. You know, you pour coffee in the cup and the coffee's there. It's not like you pour coffee in the cup and there's nothing there. There's a causal consistency due to the law of cause and effect on the gross level and on the mental level. But they're all devoid of the reality that we have been believing in,
mm-hmm.
We've been assenting to. So here, in order to first understand that as a general principle, we first investigate it on our own ego identity, on the self.
Mm-hmm.
It said that although when emptiness is presented, sometimes it's presented with respect to external phenomena first. There is no chariot in the parts.
Right.
You know, there's a famous story of a king who in India, several hundred years after the Buddha, He was a Greek king. You know who I'm talking about? Helmut, you're looking at. Happy there. Who is that? What was the monk's name? Yeah.
I don't remember the monk's name, but even Shakyamuni himself, when he was going there, there was a charioteer, and he asked him. He looked at the wheel, and he asked, you know, where is the chariot? I mean, sorry, the chariot.
Right.
Who's the chariot?
Right. Right.
Is it the wheel? Is it the charioteer? Is it this? And he basically said it's just a name.
Yeah. I don't know that particular story that the Buddha used that, but there's a famous story of an Indian, a Greek king who was in dominion over sort of the northern area like Kashmir when the Gandharva, not Gandharva, there were a certain kind of statues were being made in India that were part of the Greek culture. Anyway, the king had a very discerning mind and wanted to debate spirituality with different people. And he was so smart that most of the people he found didn't really satisfy him. He was able to demolish them with logic. And he heard that there was a Buddhist monk named Nagasena. Naga, you know, means Naga is here, right? Isn't there someone named Naga? Yeah, there's Naga. Nagasena. Sena means sometimes means army, so maybe the army of Naga. Maybe Nagasena is Naga's kids. I don't know. Can I say that? I'm joking. So anyway, Nagasena, he heard he was a great debater, so he asked him to come. And when he came, I think he came in a cart or a chariot or something, and the king greeted him, and Nagasena immediately started saying, "Who are you greeting? You know, I'm not, there's no Nagasena here." And he said, "Just like this chariot, you know, is the hub the chariot?" And the king said, no. The king, the hub is not the chariot. Is the rim, is the spokes, is the bucket, the reins?" It went through all of the different parts. So phenomena are just inexpressible names. The story I was telling you before about the Dalai Lama, so that I asked the Dalai Lama, if the table is not one with the parts and is not separate from the parts, what's the table? Where's the table? And the Dalai Lama laughed and said, that borders on the inexpressible. What is the table? It's just a name, like in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, other than the Heart Sutra, like the 8,000 verse, other Prajnaparamita Buddha, Sutras. The Buddha said at various times, Bodhisattva is just a name. Anyone who thinks, "I am a Bodhisattva," has wrong view. Well, what he means is anyone who is thinking there is a real I, an inherently existent I, and I am a bodhisattva, that's baloney, to use American expression. So how does Karen exist? That to if we investigate that first, because all of the hearers, solitary realizers, and bodhisattvas, when they first realize emptiness, their first insight into emptiness comes about through investigating the emptiness of the self. Why? Because it is has several features. It is something that is the progenitor, the matrix within which the cause of all of our delusions, all of our problems.
Mm-hmm.
It is more easily identified as being inherently existent than other things. You might say, "Well, the way you led that, George, I couldn't see the inherently existent. I couldn't identify that." It's very, very subtle, but it's more easily identified how it seems to be existing there by itself and how the mind is believing it. There's two factors you have to do. You have to actualize in meditation. Very subtle. You have to first see how it's appearing and watch with part of your mind how the rest of the mind is reacting to that appearance. Is it believing it? It's like, say, watching the kids at Christmas. Uncle Harry comes down the stairs dressed as Santa Claus, and you're looking at the kids, and some of them are going, oh, you know they think that's Santa Claus. And then some of them are going, yeah, it's Uncle Harry, you know that they, some of them are believing it, some of them are not believing it. Here, you're watching the mind. It's not different parts of your mind are believing the eye and some are not. It's all in. It's thinking, yeah, this exists. There's the ignorance and the factor of ignorance that has, or the first link of the 12 links, the 12 link ignorance that's grasping the self of persons, causes all of our problems, has existed since beginningless time in our continuum, but it can cease by developing the insight into emptiness that the I appears but is devoid or empty of that reality, that subtle reality that we attribute to it, that it's really there. You know, Uncle Harry dressed as Santa Claus looks like Santa Claus. I mean, depends on how good a costume and everything. Some people say it may not look like Santa Claus, but it generally looks like Santa Claus, but he's actually devoid, empty of being Santa Claus. The little children are like our ignorance now, the ones that whose eyes are wide and thinking, Santa Claus. And the ones that are like they're getting to be 8 and 10, and they're saying, that's Uncle Harry, that's not Santa Claus. They know. That's like our burgeoning wisdom of emptiness. And the adults in the room who know from the very beginning, there's no doubt that this looks like Santa Claus, but is not. That's like someone who's realized that, not just a beginner in that recognition. So we take the personal selflessness first of all, because to investigate, because it's more dynamic. You can instigate the sense of that I. Remember I mentioned you can go to a cemetery or, so say for instance, if you're in an accident, at that point, the sense of I appears very clearly to your mind. If your car is spinning around on the road, you might be thinking various things, I'm going to die, and memories of the past or whatever, but the I will be very apparent. So you can use dynamic situations that might otherwise be adverse conditions to your spiritual path. If you get fired, or if someone wins a court case to look for votes or something like that, and you go, oh my gosh, the I rises very, very clearly. At that point, you can use that situation to your benefit by meditating on emptiness, to recognize that is not existing. Then you can begin to recognize, just in the same way that this I appeared so clearly and doesn't exist in that way, other phenomena, you start to understand how they are appearing to be findable within their parts. You can identify that. Okay. Hemant.
Was it King Kanishka?
I might have been King Kanishka. I don't know. You said search. It's very famous. It's called the question. Oh no, King Malinda. Questions of King Malinda to Nagasena. So the title of that book is called The Questions of King Malinda. You can find it at the library. It's very nice. It's in the Pali Canon. It was written in Theravada tradition. It's not part of the canon, which is the sutras and the Vinaya and the Abhidharma, but it's extra canonical, but it's it's telling the story of this very clever Buddhist monk, Nagasena, and King Milinda, who is Greek, I think, was the interrogator. Okay, enough of that. So let's get back to our Heart Sutra. I hope you're, Karen, you're satisfied enough. Not grasping right now, okay. So yesterday we got to the point we said, you know, that Avalokiteshvara has been speaking for some time to Shariputra. He said, you know, such as Shariputra, therefore in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness, no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, no phenomena. We talked about this, the five aggregates, the six faculties, the 12 entrances, which means the faculties and their objects, and then what are called the eight 18 dhatus, which includes, you know, the eye organ, the objects of sight, visual forms, and eye consciousness. It's three things: the ear organ, sounds, and ear consciousness, three more things. Through all six of the consciousnesses, that makes 18, right? You up on your math? Three times six. Those are called the 18 dhatus. And the object of mental consciousness are called dharmas. So they're called dharma dhatu. That includes all phenomena, but it is because one of the exclusive objects of mental consciousness is emptiness. Sometimes the name dharma dhatu refers to emptiness itself. And he went on, Avalokiteshvara went on to say that the 12 links are also in their forward order, contaminated order, ignorance, karmic formations, and so forth, up to death with or without aging. Those 12 are empty. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. So that's adding together the what are called the contaminated 12 links. Because of ignorance, karmic formation comes about. Because of karmic formation, there's an imprint of consciousness. Consciousness is the third link, and so forth, up till the last one. And then what's called the pure, that's called the contaminated, the pure 12 links is having extinguished ignorance, having ceased ignorance, there is no karmic formation. And since karmic formation would be exhausted or extinct, there is no imprint in the mind, karmic imprint any longer being produced. Because of that, there is no name and form. And so that's called the pure side of the forward order of the 12 links. So he's basically saying this very important realization that the sharper faculty disciples of the Buddha would spend time on, that's an adjunct to the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are a way of understanding our dilemma and how to get out of it. Our dilemma is suffering and the cause of suffering. The solution is cessation of suffering, so cessation of the causes, and how to bring about that cessation, the path that leads to cessation, the Four Noble Truths. The 12 links go about another way to understand our situation in more detail, and it said those of sharper intellect that are trying to develop renunciation and understand emptiness and so forth, they add to their understanding of the Four Noble Truths meditation a long time on the 12 links. of dependent origination. It said that the solitary realizers, remember the two kind of disciples of lesser, I thought Diana was bowing to the 12 links, but she was bowing because she had to go off to see, she had some appointment. So the hearers mainly meditate on the Four Noble Truths, and the Pratyeka Buddhas who have sharper intellect and remain in cyclic existence for longer time in order to achieve their more extensive arhatship, they're sort of superior to the hearers. They mainly take the 12 links of dependent origination as their main object of meditation. So then, again, from last time, similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. So the Four Noble Truths, although they might, before you have an understanding of emptiness, you may be grasping to them as having some kind of real findable existence. They exist. They are consistent. They are valid, but they are empty of the reality that our mind, that's still grasping the true existence, attributes to them. So that's what it's meant. There is no suffering. It doesn't mean that conventionally suffering doesn't exist. It means that to the mind that realizes emptiness, there is no inherently existent suffering. There is no inherently existent cessation or as an origination of suffering, cause of suffering. There is no inherently existent cessation of suffering. It doesn't mean that they don't exist at all. There is no gnosis or exalted wisdom. There is no attainment and also no non-attainment. That's how far we got last time. So here, all of these previous understandings are understood by the mind, by a deep wisdom that is called, here is translated exalted wisdom. We could call it gnosis. It is in, if you're studying the Prajna Paramita, it's Prajna applied, this wisdom applied to understanding these things. So similarly, there is no exalted wisdom. What does that mean? Of course you have wisdom. You have, if you've understood these previous things, previous lists of things as being empty of inherent existence, those are themselves examples of exalted wisdom. But the way that you might think, you might have a kind of erroneous view that thinks all these other things are empty, but the consciousness that knows them is empty, that exists. That's, you know, that you can't deny that. I know those things and because of this is really existing. That too. Even the wisdom that knows them is empty of inherent existence, that in no way diminishes its efficacy or conventional reality. It is legitimate to attribute, to designate, to impute upon the consciousness that has these understandings the name exalted wisdom. But to think that there really within that there is exalted wisdom inherently is an error. When we do the Mahamudra meditation that we were doing at the beginning, first we watch the clear light nature of the mind, we get familiar with that to develop concentration. Then within that we bring up the sense of self, like we did this morning. We investigate that and eventually, after a long period of time, we may have an insight into selflessness of persons. Then we apply that to the mind itself that was realizing the selflessness of persons. It's kind of like there is no exalted wisdom. We analyze the mind and we recognize it's appearing to us as having this clear light nature, but that clear light nature, the conventional clear light nature of the mind, appears to us as having some findable inherent existence. When you analyze it as having parts, that it can't be, you know, there are momentary parts of the mind. The mind at 2:02 and 30 seconds, the mind at 2:02 and 32 seconds, and so forth. The mind can't be found on any of them. It's just a name that we attribute to a continuum of clarity and knowing. You can realize the emptiness of the mind. So that's kind of what's being inferred here. There is no exalted wisdom means even the mind that's realizing all of these things that we've just said, this is empty, there's no eye, no ear, that mind itself appears, but is empty of inherent existence. There is no attainment and no non-attainment. So we might think, oh, I've realized perfect human rebirth. You know, I've had the attainment. Attainment here means achieving some goal, right? In terms of realizations. So you may think that you have that, but that itself appears to the mind. We may have some kind of hazy understanding of it, but once we understand something well, we say, oh, I've realized impermanence, you know, death. I've achieved or attained the realization that I'm definitely going to die. Maybe you've had some experience. That may be true conventionally. You may have that realization or attainment, but that attainment itself doesn't inherently exist. Like, say, the attainment of Buddhahood. Remember, we were talking before. All these other things, samsaric beings, samsara, maybe I can understand how they're like illusions, but hey, Buddha, he's the man, you know, that's real. That's inherently existent. No, that state of mind that was once contaminated, practiced the Bodhisattva path and achieved omniscience, that too is empty of inherent existence. To the meditative equipoise on emptiness of the Buddha, the omniscient mind, all phenomena, inner and outer phenomena of the past, the present, and the future, all can appear, but that mind knows that all of them, even the Buddha's own mind and achievements, are empty of inherent existence. They appear one way, but they're actually empty of that, like a dream, like an illusion, like an echo, like a reflection, and so forth. Is it time for break? I see a lot of you chewing, taking snack time. Yeah, a couple minutes, okay? So then, this is where we got last time. Shariputra, again, he's telling Shariputra to pay attention, like I can say to you, Robbie? Hey, Robbie. Oh, okay. His eyebrows went up. He's paying attention. So, Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. You might say, well, if there is no attainment, what does that mean? Why, therefore, because there is no attainment, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. So we say, because phenomena lack inherent existence, they can change. Because attainments, the various attainments on the level, on the stages of the bodhisattva, they exist conventionally, validly, they have a causal effect and so forth on appearances. but they are empty of inherent existence. Therefore, they can be achieved. You might say, oh, Buddhahood or realization of what's tough, bodhicitta or guru devotion, man, that's not attainable. That's like somewhere else. You're here and that's somewhere else. If you realize that the attainment of these realizations itself is empty of inherent existence, you begin to recognize the possibility of changing, that can be achieved. It's not like you are like inherently different than that realization. Maybe that's one sense of Tantra, when you bring we call Tantra the resultant vehicle. We try to bring the result, the effect of Buddhahood into our present experience. Imagine that. We start to understand, through understanding emptiness, that we are, in a sense, we are more Yamantaka. We are more Avalokiteshvara, Tara, you know, than we are, because the imagination of oneself as Yamantaka or Tara or Avalokiteshvara is one in which you recognize from the very beginning, out of emptiness, arising as just this appearance which you understand as devoid of inherent existence. That's actually more higher you are, because you will eventually be that, than how your mind grasps to yourself now. You grasp to yourself now as inherently existent with no compromise. So Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, no inherently existent attainment, they can be attained. So the bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. All of their practices, the practices of all of the six perfections, are all unified with all of the six perfections, but particularly the perfection of wisdom. You realize the giver, the agent of giving, yourself as a bodhisattva, doesn't inherently exist. The action of giving doesn't inherently exist through the perfection of wisdom. And the recipient of the giving doesn't inherently exist. The same, in a similar kind of way when we dedicate merits in the emptiness of the three spheres. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, no inherently existent attainments, bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, because it's that which will propel them to make the attainments. The mind without obscuration and without fear. So as they dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the various obstacles to your practice, low self-esteem or hesitancy, miserliness, to give, impatience with others, as you dwell in the perfection of wisdom, these obstructions, these obstacles, are eliminated. They rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration. So that can also mean having dwelled in the perfection of wisdom, one eliminates the two kinds of obstructions. Generally, we can categorize all the obstructions in the mind in two categories, what are called the afflictive obstructions, which are all the delusions and their seeds, right? Afflictive obstructions. They obstruct mainly liberation from samsara. And then they're called the obstructions to omniscience, to knowing all phenomena. Maybe you've heard Geshe-la talk about that. She-dib. She means, it refers to the knowing, and dip means obstruction. So those prevent the attainment of enlightenment. Mainly the afflictive obstructions mainly obstruct you from achieving liberation from samsara, obstruct you from achieving nirvana. The obstructions to omniscience mainly are preventing you from achieving Buddhahood. So bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom, the mind without obscuration and without fear. So we talk about the four fearlessnesses. You know, sometimes on the throne, I don't know, in the merit field, yeah. Can you see up in the Tanka here? You can't see, it's too far away. There, the Buddha, Lama Tsongkhapa in the center is seated upon a throne, and that throne is supported in the corners by four snow lions. Are you looking, Nili? Can you see? You got good eyes. Can you see that in my picture?
Huh? Yeah. You see someone at the very top. Is that who you're talking about?
The one in the middle up there, that's Lama Tsongkhapa. Let's see if I can. So right here and here, there are two that are in the front in the corners that are holding. There are two more in the back. They represent the four fearlessnesses of the Buddha. So in a sense, emptiness, realization of emptiness, the perfection of wisdom, is the sort of like the panacea to all fears. We talk about in the Lama Chopa Puja, just before we do sok, or, you know, there's a verse saying, Kyoni Lama, Kyoni Yidam, Kyoni Khandro Chokyongte. You are the Yidams, you are the Dakinis, you are the Dharma protectors also. From now until I reach enlightenment, I will seek no other refuge than you. Now, from now and in the Bardo intermediate state and future lives, please hold me with the hooks of your compassion. Sishi Jikdrol, liberate me from the fears of cyclic existence, Sipa, and Sishi, peace, pacification, the two kinds of fears. So in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, we talk about the hearers and solitary realizers have a fear of cyclic existence. And so they don't fear nirvana. They'd like to have that. The bodhisattvas have not only a fear of cyclic existence, which they can pacify with realizing emptiness, but they have a fear of falling into the peace of nirvana, you know, the lesser goal. And so they meditate on bodhicitta to overcome that. The Hinayana arhats don't have that luxury. That's why they fall into that peace. So the mind without obscuration and without fear, because of having relied on and dwelled in the perfection of wisdom, they reach the end point of nirvana. They reach the completion of nirvana. So here, nirvana doesn't mean the ordinary nirvana of the Hinayana arhats. It can mean the Mahayana nirvana, can mean the great nirvana of enlightenment, parinirvana of enlightenment. Okay, I'm just going to read the next line, then we take a break, or the next paragraph here. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. So all the Buddhas, the past, the present, the future, they have, they are, they will depend on the perfection of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita, to bring about the what's called this Samyaksam Buddha, you know, the perfectly complete, manifest, completely awakened to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the. Nili's here, but Naga, did Naga leave? Does she have another name that I don't recognize? Her? Oh, there she is. Yeah, she is.
I'm here.
So you should get, you should search in the bookstores or Amazon for The Questions of King Melinda and give your daughter a copy for her next, you know, whatever is birthday. Or...
Her name is S-C-N-N-A, Senna, that means gold. Senali.
Oh, her name is Senna Gold.
Yeah.
Not the Senna of Army. Okay, but anyways. She's part of your army, your children, right?
Venerable Chernoff, I found actually the Questions of Melinda is in, if you Google it, there's a whole article by Barbara O'Brien, and it's called Learning Religions, and it says King Melinda's Questions and Chariot Smile.
Oh, great.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Hemant. So anyone, maybe you could send the link to Donna, and if anyone wants, they can ask her.
Will do.
Anyway, thank you. Okay. Hey, Karen, that David's off. Okay, so.
He's coming. He's grabbing
okay.
Some.
Yeah.
I have one question.
Yes, please. Yeah, while we're waiting, question.
How do we keep in touch with you after the class? Are you available or?
You can, you could either, if you email me, don't expect an answer right away, you know, because sometimes I get busy, but you could email me if you have, I won't, because this may be on YouTube or something, I won't say what my email address is, so you can ask Donna, and Donna, I can say you could give someone who's sincere and want to ask some questions. You can, don't expect an answer right away. You might get it eventually. Okay?
I'd be happy to do that. Venerable George, I've also, there are a couple of students who would like to make personal offerings to you. How can we organize that?
Oh, okay. I sent you my mailing address and the Zelle.
Mm-hmm.
They could send it to a bank account. I have a bank account at Bank of America, believe it or not.
I made a Venerable Amy to sign up for Venmo.
Oh, okay.
It's very easy.
Yeah.
She likes it.
Yeah, I don't have that, so I'm not going to offer that right now. Okay, let's get back to, can you hear me, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't sure there's some icon next to my name there. So now we've reached a point, a little bit interesting change in the structure here, because up till now, the Heart Sutra has been a very similar to the Prajnaparamita Sutras, referring to the Sutra path and so forth. But now there's the introduction of mantra. Mantra is usually associated with the practice of Tantra or the resultant vehicle. And it's kind of interesting. So it says, therefore, and this is a little bit unclear when saying therefore, as though something that was said before is going to be, because of that, the following happens. It's not quite clear, even in the commentaries, they say it's not quite clear why the Heart Sutra says therefore. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, in other words, the mantra of the Prajnaparamita, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equaled to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering should be known as truth since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared, Tadyata, Gate Gate, Para Gate, Para Samgate, Bodhi, Svaha. I've left off the Om. Sometimes many of the sutras don't have the Om, but some do, so I'll say again. Tadyata, Om, Gate Gate, Para Gate, Para Samgate, Bodhi, Svaha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. So if you left out the section about the mantra, where it started with therefore, you could almost, sort of a continuation there, you know, that he, Avalokiteshvara, last said, before the mantra, he said, all the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awakened, unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment and reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva, should train in the profound perfection like that. So if you left out the mantra, kind of makes sense. But there's no indication that there are earlier versions without the mantra. The Dalai Lama has said, and the commentaries say, it's an interesting kind of juxtaposition to find within sutras reliance upon mantra. Sometimes in the sutras we use another term called dharanis. Do you know what dharani means? Oh, good. I can see. There's no one nodding. Is anyone nodding yes?
Meditation? Is it meditation?
Who said that?
Me. Naga.
No, me. I'm trying to look at all those things. So no, dharani comes from the same root of dharma. Dharani is that we call retentions. It's kind of like long mantras, like the long mantra of Avalokiteshvara. Do you know the long mantra? The general long mantra. There's even longer ones in Chinese, but... Was that Namo Ratna Trayaya Nama Aya Gyana Sagara Vairochana Vuharachaya, this mantra. That's called the long dharani of Avalokiteshvara. Dharanis also have a meaning that they helped, they were kind of lists that were recited in the Abhidharma tradition of Theravada Buddhism to help you remember long lists. And in a sense, by reciting this, which is almost like a mantra, you know, not a lot, no explanatory words in between, it helped you to retain the meaning of what was being listed, kind of sense of that retentions to hold. So you do find that in some of the sutras, talking about dharanis, but you don't find mantra. So this is a little bit unusual. Dalai Lama has said that may, you know, it might have some very profound significance. So at any rate, the text, as we're saying here, says in English, therefore, again, therefore is not clear why it's saying therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom. And we do notice in Tantra texts when for the deity Prajnaparamita, which means the deity, like this is a very excellent book if you haven't seen Echoes of Voidness by the great Geshe Rabten. Steve Batchelor was the compiler of that. At the beginning there is a translation of the Heart Sutra and Geshe-la's commentary, Geshe Rabten's commentary on the perfection of wisdom, of the Heart Sutra, rather. So the mantra of perfection, well, the reason I showed you this, actually, is that is the deity Prajnaparamita. There are other variations, but that is four arms. Two of them are in meditative equipoise on her lap, and one of them's holding the Wisdom Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra, and the other is holding a vajra. You see that? So in the practice of Prajnaparamita, this mantra is also found, also used. So therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, there might be some connection between that practice and the sutra. The mantra of great knowledge, Rikpa Chempo Ngak. So it bestows and holds great knowledge. The unsurpassed mantra, because we're talking about the wisdom gone beyond, right? Unsurpassed. The mantra equaled to the unequaled. The mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering. Sometimes when the Dalai Lama gives discourse with the monks and so forth, and the Heart Sutra is recited, afterwards there's another verse that's recited along with this mantra to, and one claps three times. Do you know that? Have you ever seen that? And imagining dispelling obstructions, pacifying all sorts of obstructions and suffering. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom should be known as truth, that it, since it is not false. So in all of the commentaries, there's not much commentarial take on that preamble here before the mantra. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared, Tadyata Om Gate 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 Paragate Parasamgate Bodhi Svaha. So if you take, whether you add the Om or not, the explanation of the mantra in regard to the perfection of wisdom seems to be generally accepted by all of the commentators in this way. It is indicating the progression on the five Mahayana paths. Have you heard of the five paths? The path of accumulation of merit, sometimes called, I think Edward Conze calls it the path of armoring, you know, getting all of the requisites, accumulating merit, like the army that's going to go off to war, getting their armor and their swords and their cavalry, their horses and the weapons and everything. So path of accumulation, path of preparation, or could be called the path of connection. Path of accumulation, path of preparation. Those are paths that are mundane paths. That is to say, one enters into the path of accumulation having developed effortless bodhicitta. That's the defining characteristic. You have entered into the Mahayana path at that point. You may have awakened the Mahayana lineage, I mentioned earlier, by developing great compassion. But once you have bodhicitta, once you have effortless, spontaneous bodhicitta, you are a bodhisattva, you've entered into the path of accumulation that might last a great eon when you are accumulating merit and wisdom and developing single-pointed concentration and maybe familiarizing yourself with emptiness. Then at the point when you have developed what's called the union of calm abiding and penetrative insight. Remember that terminology? The union of shamatha and vipassana. So you have concentration, and then you've learned how to analyze within that, and you begin to apply that analysis to emptiness. You enter, the bodhisattva changes from the path of accumulation to the path of preparation or the path of connection. You could say he's preparing for the path of seeing, which is the third path, or it's the path that connects to the path of seeing, because it's there on the path of preparation that you have a realization of emptiness with the union of calm abiding, perfect concentration, and the Vipassana, the wisdom that analyzes within that. And you have developed a perfect mental image. It's not yet a direct realization of emptiness. You have a perfect mental image of emptiness that is factually concordant. After a long period of time meditating on that, the conceptual understanding via that mental image, the mental image becomes more and more transparent, like the removal of the veils of the king's most prized consorts. You know, so the many veils to keep other ones. Finally, the final veil, and you see directly on the path of seeing. You directly see emptiness. It's called the third path, and it's upon that point, at that point, that one becomes an Arya being. One becomes a superior being. One realizes emptiness directly and has your first experience of true cessation. You cease certain set of the afflictions so that they will never arise again. Sometimes we call them the intellectually formed afflictions. They're not innate to the mind. They're afflictions that come about because of misunderstanding things, but they still are ceased, so they will never arise again. Path of accumulation, path of preparation, path of seeing. And then once arising from that, as you again enter into meditation on emptiness, you enter into what's called the path of meditation. Or you could call it the path of familiarization or cultivation. You continue, like we said, correctly and repeatedly, you know, looking at the five aggregates as empty of inherent existence also. Remember earlier, so repeatedly. So on the path of meditation, one actually then begins to get rid of the instinctual, the innate afflictions to the mind. It's in the latter part of the path of meditation that one begins to eliminate the obstructions to omniscience. I'll mention that again in a second. So those are four paths. Path of preparation. These are called the paths of learning. The path of preparation, the path of path of accumulation, the path of preparation, path of seeing, the path of meditation. And at the end of the path of meditation, when all of the klesha have been abandoned, ceased, there's true cessation of them, and one is eliminated, all but the most final obstruction to omniscience, one becomes a 10th level bodhisattva. In fact, the 10th level bodhisattva is almost like a Buddha. He or she can enter into meditation on emptiness and arise from that meditation in a thought instant. So even though they don't see both levels of truth at the same time, it's almost the same. You know, they go from one to the other in a thought instant. It's at that point one enters into the final meditative absorption, like the Buddha did in Bodh Gaya, like Shakyamuni did on the Vajra seat under the Bodhi tree. They call it the Vajra seat, right? So this is called the Vajra-like samadhi on emptiness at the end of the path of meditation. And at that point, all of the last obstructions to omniscience, the cessation of those, the extinction of those takes place, and one enters into the fifth path, which is called the path of no more learning. In a worldly sense, what's the path of no more learning in school? Graduation, right? You know, There's no more. But, even in the world, there's other things to learn, right? But the path of no more learning is synonymous with the path of no more learning for the Mahayana is synonymous with Buddhahood. One has become a Buddha. One has the omniscient mind. One has achieved the enjoyment body, the Sambhogakaya, and one has achieved the Nirmanakaya, that one can display, the emanation body that one can display for the benefit of sentient beings leading them. So those are called the five paths. So the mantra generally is understood this way. Gate, or the tayata, it is like this, right? It's kind of, maybe this is implying the prelude of getting ready to enter into the Mahayana. So gate means gone. That refers to the path of accumulation. Because one has entered into the Mahayana path, you've gone beyond the ordinary minds of sentient beings. You've entered into the Mahayana path. Gate. Second gate, gate means entering in to the path of preparation. You've left the path of accumulation and you've gone to the path of preparation, in which you are preparing to realize emptiness directly. Kind of the way that you're preparing is by getting the union of tranquil abiding and penetrative insight to meditate repeatedly on emptiness so that you remove more and more of the veils or the obstructions that prevent you from seeing emptiness directly. So gate, gate, those are called the two mundane paths of the five paths. Because the path of seeing, when you see emptiness directly, you become an Arya, that is called one of the supra-mundane paths. Supra here doesn't mean super. Right? Supra means beyond, right? Supra-mundane. So you've gone beyond the ordinary beings. You've developed bodhicitta. The second gate, you've gone beyond that and you're beginning to realize emptiness in this very efficient way. Now, gate, para gate. Para, like paramita. Para means beyond. So gate, gate, para gate. You've become a superior being. You've gone beyond the mundane. This is the progression that you would make in realizing emptiness. Gate, gate, para gate. Once you've gone beyond the ordinary mundane states that have not realized emptiness directly, on the path of seeing, you've paragate, gone beyond, then familiarizing with that, on the path of meditation, you begin to eliminate the instinctual afflictions, and you eliminate true cessation of the obstructions to omniscience. So there, that stage is called parasamgate. Sam here means completely, you could say completely. So you could say gone completely beyond, because now you're eliminating all of the afflictions from the mind. It's the fourth path of meditation. And then at the end of the path of meditation, entering into the Vajra-like samadhi on emptiness, you eliminate the final obstructions to omniscience and you achieve bodhi. No more learning. Graduation. It sounds like when you say path, the path of no more learning, it sounds like there's still something you're doing because you're going on a path. But from that point on, your mind is spontaneous. There's no longer intellectual planning. Everything that one does out of great compassion and bodhicitta for sentient beings takes place spontaneously and effortlessly. There's no need to sort of rev up and think to do something when something needs to be done for sentient beings. One already knew beforehand, and your mind stream affects that, manifesting, giving teachings, cultivating sentient beings' minds in various ways, inspiring them. Svaha, the last syllable here, is kind of like what I joked before, like amen. Here, svaha has the sense of may it take root, may this come to be. You know, that's kind of what we mean. Isn't that kind of what we mean by amen? Yeah. May it be, you know. So tadyata, it's like this. Tadyata means literally, it is thus. Whether the om is there or not, if the om is there, it's really kind of like a mantra. Otherwise, it's kind of like a dharani. Usually mantras always have om. Well, mantras generally have om, ah, hum in them. This mantra has om. If you put the om in, it has ah in, you know, ga, te, ga, te, para. There's ah in various places, but it doesn't have hum. So it's perhaps more sutra-like. So sometimes it's recited without om. Sometimes it's recited with om. So if you're following a discourse and it's being recited, you have to wait a second to see whether the group, whether the leader is saying om or not. Right? Tadyata. It's like this. Gate, path of accumulation. Gate, path of preparation or connection. Paragate, path of seeing when you've gone beyond the mundane, the super mundane. Parasamgate, gone completely beyond. Bodhi, the fifth path of no more learning, Buddhahood, svaha, may it be. So if we leave that in, then the next sentence that Avalokiteshvara says, I think it's the last that he says, is Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Why does he say that? Well, you remember from the beginning, Shariputra said, you know, he said to Avalokiteshvara, how should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom? So, as Avalokiteshvara gave answer, he was answering that question. How should someone of the Mahayana lineage, son or daughter of the lineage, that means someone who's not only awakened the lineage, but perhaps entered into the path, the Mahayana path, with bodhicitta, how should they train? The bodhisattva, mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that, just as he's explained, meditating on all of these factors as empty. In many of the commentaries, there are attempts to explain the various sections, besides the mantra, explaining the various sections as referring to before the path of accumulation, you know, like leading up to that, meditating on bodhicitta and so forth, and a section that mainly talking about bodhicitta, path of preparation, how one meditates on the path of preparation, one meditates in the path of seeing, the path of meditation, and the consequence in the path of no more learning and omniscience, the state of omniscience in Buddhahood. If we have time at the end, I'll read a section. There are many different, they break it up slightly different, overlapping, but you might, if you like to, you can find in the commentaries an explanation of that, dividing up the sections of the sutra giving reasons why at this point he seems to be talking about the practice of the perfection of wisdom, the path of accumulation, or the path of preparation, the path of seeing, the path of meditation, path of no more learning. So then, the Buddha sort of, well, I'm exaggerating. He was meditating. Now he arises from that meditative equipoise in which he has been perceiving the varieties of phenomena, all conventional phenomena, within the sphere of knowing them as empty of inherent existence. Remember how do we translate here? At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the varieties of phenomena, or the categories of phenomena, called profound perception. So one part of his mind is conventional, realizing the conventional reality that sentient beings have appearing to them, how they understand things, you know, how they appear as horses and people and fences and realizations and so forth, the variety of phenomena. Yet within that, he realizes that all of them are empty of inherent existence, the perfection of the profound. So then the Bhagavan at the end, the Bhagavan arose from that concentration. That's what he was which was inspiring Shariputra to ask the question and inspiring Avalokiteshvara, maybe empowering him to give that answer, very concise, well, concise compared to the long perfection of wisdom, right? Just a page or two. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, son of the lineage. It is like that. It is like that. It says twice. One should practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you have indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. That's all the Buddha says. Even though it's called the sutra, right? Usually you think of the sutra as the discourse of the Buddha. This is a sutra that the main part of the sutra is inspired by the Buddha and delivered by Shariputra, the question, brief question, and the longer explanation of Avalokiteshvara, Arya Avalokiteshvara. So when I taught once in Malaysia, I went on a tour from Singapore. They asked me to go. A lot of little centers didn't have teachers coming, so they said, if you went here, then you could go here, and then you're here. You end up in Penang. You go across from Singapore, and you go, is anyone from Asia here? None of you are. So along the way, a couple of the places, there were different kinds of disciples. Some of them were Mahayana practitioners, even though Malaysia is officially a Muslim country, and you can't convert from Islam to any other religion. You can't become a Catholic, Christian, a Jew, or a Buddhist if you were born as a Muslim. It's interesting. So, but there were people who were Chinese nationals who were Buddhist to begin with, so there were some Mahayana places that I would teach at, and there were some that were native Theravadins, born to you know, lineage, Malaysians maybe, or transplanted from India or other places. And so in one of those, when I gave a teaching on the Dharma, at the end they would say, after, you know, they would thank and they say, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What does that mean, Naga? Or Nili, maybe. I'm not sure if Nili is Indian or not.
It's Nili. Sadhu, isn't that like someone who's a very learned or a wise person or something like that?
Well, that's one meaning. Yeah, that's one.
What? Namaskar. Sadhu is like a saint, but I think there should be some other meaning. But
yeah, it's not spelled the same way, but sadhu here means well said.
Oh.
You know, lekso, lekso. Tibetan says lekso, lekso. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Like I remember once at Land of Medicine Buddha when I was first visiting there, one of the board of directors at lunch, he asked me some Dharma question. I cleared up some confusion in his mind, hopefully. And he said, oh, well said. said like, yeah, that was, I got it. That was eloquent or something like that. So here the Buddha is saying, sadhu, sadhu. Sometimes in the Tibetan, because it says lekso, shejawa, lekso, lekso, it sounds like lekso or sadhu comes three times. There's a tradition of that, but also here when it says lekso shejawa, he gave a lekso, that kind of means he gave a commendation. He commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, saying, well said, well said. So sometimes in the Tibetan, it looks like the phrase lekso comes three times, but one of them is embedded in the word commended. So he says a commendation by saying, I commend you, or well said, well said. Son of the lineage, it is like that. So he is affirming here that what Avalokiteshvara said is indeed correct. It is like that. He says a second time, one should practice the profound perfection of wisdom just as you have indicated, just as you have explained. Even the Tathagatas couldn't do any better. Even the Tathagatas will rejoice upon such an explanation. They find nothing wrong with what you said. So it's upon that statement of the Buddha at the end that the final paragraph comes. The Bhagavan, referring to the Buddha, right? The Lord, the endowed transcendent destroyer, however you'd like to translate it into English. The Bhagavan, having thus spoken, the venerable, as a result of the Buddha spoken, having spoken like that, the venerable Shariputra, using the slightly longer name for Shariputra, the venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, the two interrogators, and those surrounding and in their entirety, because there's a great assembly of monks, a great assembly of bodhisattvas, there are gods of the desire realm, headed by Indra. There are gods of the form realm headed by Brahma. Bodhisattvas hovering out in space around. There's a whole bunch of people. So the Bodhisattva Shariputra Avalokiteshvara and those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras. You know who the asuras are? Asuras, when we talk about the gods of the desire realm, we talk about the devas. And a little bit lower than the devas are what are called the asuras. There's one way. They are what are called maybe the demigods or the jealous gods. They are on the sides of Mount Meru. The devas are actually on the top of Mount Meru and maybe hovering in space above that, the devas of the desire realm, the gods of the desire realm, headed by Indra. And the asuras are, the word asura in India comes from, remember that I said the letter A at the beginning of a word sometimes is a negative particle, so they have no sura. Do you know what sura is? Sura was the beverage, intoxicating beverage of the gods, and So they are ones that abstain from that. So they're called asuras, but they're not gods. They're a little bit lower, kind of jealous of the gods. Kind of like, what would it be? Kind of like the second tier in Hollywood, right? The gods are like, you know, Jennifer Aniston or George Clooney or something, you know, Brad Pitt and or Julia, whatever her name is, Roberts. And then the asuras are the ones that are kind of jealous of them. They don't get the same respect. I love that. No respect. So so all of these people are, what are they doing? So Shariputra, Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, including the worlds of gods, humans, asuras, Gandharvas. You know what Gandharvas are? The Gandharvas, one meaning of Gandharvas is actual beings within cyclic existence, that the kind of spirits that live on Gandha's odor, fragrance, and one sometimes burns incense for them. But it's also a name that's given to the beings of the intermediate state, and even the pretas sometimes called Gandharvas. But there are beings, the Gandharvas come up in the Prajnaparamita Sutra sometimes, because certain beings, certain kind of spirits, with their power, they make an illusion of a city. You know, like, wow, look at that. If you have the clairvoyance, you can see the city that they've created through their magical power. It looks so amazing, kind of like something out of Star Wars or something. But then that can disintegrate in an instant. It's just totally an illusion, not like an illusion. It is an illusion. So the along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and Gandharvas, they were overjoyed. They rejoiced in what the Buddha said and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. So it almost sounds like it said that which the Buddha, they praised what the Buddha said. This is like giving short shrift to what Avalokiteshvara said. But actually what Avalokiteshvara said was actually the words of the Buddha, inspired by the Buddha. So one can understand it that way. This completes the Arya Bhagavati Prajnaparamita Hridaya Sutra. So the Buddha doesn't say a lot, but he affirms that what Avalokiteshvara Arya, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said was right, correct. Even the Tathagatas, the Buddhas, other Buddhas would not find any fault. They would rejoice in what he said. It was right on. So that's a short exposition of the Heart Sutra. To do justice to a lot of things, we would spend a lot more time. But we've got a couple of minutes left, and I bet there could be some questions. Maybe not. Anyone have something they want to, Elise?
I think I'm beginning to understand how self does not exist as we think it does, that it's something that's always evolving and interdependent and related to everything around us. But yet, there is some, like an individual essence, separate individual essences that exist throughout all time, like the mental continuum.
So one might think, okay, George, there's no Atma, there's no self inherently existent, but come on, the mental continuum that is, we say, has existed since beginningless time until now, and will at one point practice the Mahayana path and eliminate afflictions, maybe further on in the path of, you know, meditation, eliminate the obstructions to omniscience, and eventually that mind stream will continue and it itself will become the omniscient mind. Come on, George, that exists. That's your question, right?
Yes.
So that too, remember we said, even when we meditate in Mahamudra, we meditate first on the, just recognizing the mental continuum, the clear light nature. We use that concentration to recognize the object of negation of personal selflessness, recognizing selflessness of persons, and then we apply that to the mind itself. This mind stream that you're talking about that's existed from beginningless time and will exist into the future of our Buddhahood, that too is empty of inherent existence. So there, you might say that's an essence, but generally in Buddhism, this the term essence kind of implies some kind of substantial existence, something existing there from its own side. So this is essenceless. There is indeed a conventional mind that continues. And from the point of view of the Vajrayana, why do I mention that? Because Lama Tsongkhapa said that it's important, if you're studying the Mahayana Sutras, it's important also to study the Tantras, because in his own studies of Tantra, there were certain perplexing questions about the Sutra path, maybe the Prajnaparamita and others, that having studied Tantra, he could say, oh, there's the solution. That's how to understand it. And there's some things in Tantra that through an extensive knowledge of the Sutra path become more clear. So here, from the point of view of Tantra, the mind stream that has existed from the past to the present and the future, never ending, it is always accompanied by a mounting wind, it is mounted on a wind. It is inseparable from a wind which acts as its motility, from a prana. You know the word prana, right? In yoga, people say pranayama.
Okay.
Breathe in. Prana can mean wind, can mean vitality. So Tibetan says lung. Sometimes if you've meditated a long time and concentration, you try to do your Vajrasattva retreat and you don't take any break, you can end up with what's called lung, sort of like depression or pain in the heart, because you've concentrated unskillfully and you've caused some of the prana, some of the lung, to get stuck because of the nadis not open. So the mind is like a rider, horsewoman, upon the horse of the wind, the prana. Inseparable. Our mental consciousness, the factor of clarity and knowing, it's like the rider, and the inseparable motility that moves it from one object to another is called the wind. That prana is like a body, is like the form aggregate, the subtle form aggregate that has continued. It's never been just a mind stream. You might think, oh, the mind enters into a fertilized egg and then has a body of flesh and blood or something else, you know, sort of visible form. But from the very beginning, it's always always had a subtle body associated with it, the prana. And it's upon that combination of body and mind, because the continuum of mind has discrimination, has feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and primary consciousness. It's upon that combination that you can impute a self. And, you know, right now you're called Elise, but you were not always called Elise. You might have been called Elise some lives, but other lives you had other names. Sometimes you didn't have a name. I don't know if a beetle gives names to its children. Might have a concept of the different ones, or the, you know, so that constitutes similar to name. But that person, primordial person, samsaric person, will eventually enter into the Mahayana path, become an Arya, and achieve enlightenment. But that person also, even the person imputed on the subtle mind and wind, that person also is empty of inherent existence. So just like these other things, like we remember we said this kind of a conundrum. Sorry. Oh, okay, samsara, it's empty, but nirvana or Buddha, that exists. Remember we said even Buddhahood doesn't inherently exist. Like everything else, it's exists conventionally as just a name, like the Buddha said in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, many different ways, he said, one phrase that comes up again, Bodhisattva is just a name. You know, there's no findable Bodhisattva. It's just a concept attributed to that. Like the table is just the designation or name, table given to that. You can't find it in the parts other than the parts. If you're not satisfied with just that name, you're falling under the influence of ignorance that's looking for some kind of inherent existence. Phenomena are just a name, just a concept. It doesn't have to be a verbally, table, bodhisattva, elise, or something. It can be just the thought, concept, without verbalization. We say names and concepts. Phenomena are imputed by name and concept. That's their only kind of valid conventional existence. The appearances by themselves only are recognized as objects when we give them a name or concept. Mama, you know, or the cow that licks the salt block doesn't think salt block, but it has some concept. That's a nice, you know, kind of memory. That's a nice thing. So phenomena only come into existence conventionally through the process of imputation by name and thought. There is no, you know, in emptiness, in reality, phenomena lack the kind of existence that appears to us until we achieve Buddhahood, even the 10th level Bodhisattva. As they perceive things, phenomena still appear to be inherently existent. The appearance of the conventionally existent, merely imputed table is mixed with the appearance of an inherently existent table. We can't extricate them. But at the point of Buddhahood, when the last obstructions to omniscience are eliminated, the Buddha perceives all the conventional phenomena as mere imputations, without any inherent existence, and recognizes the emptiness of all those phenomena.
Venerable George, this is Kim.
I'm trying to find Kim, okay.
You Wait find me?
Oh, there you are, yeah.
Hi. So the challenge that I'm having right now is that we are advised to perfect our good qualities and let go and not feed the things that keep us from understanding more and more and more and more to become Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is that if something is the idea of moving in a direction in the terms of moving towards improving your good qualities to me is a direction. And a direction to me is seen as object one having a vector that moves towards object two. So when I think of things not having any inherent existence, I have trouble moving in a direction that does not have vectors because there's no objects. Am I making myself clear?
Yeah. So Kim either teaches algebra or is an engineer. So we're talking about vectors. I remember studying vectors in calculus and trigonometry and everything. So if I say I wanted to go from where I am, and my goal is to get where Kim is. So I'm up here north of Asheville. I assume you're down in
Raleigh.
Raleigh, okay. So that means I have to go from here to there. We could put the vector. Maybe it has to have a couple turns down the turnpike. But if I try to say Kim's location, where exactly is it? And we say it's in North Carolina, it's in Raleigh, it's on so-and-so street at this address, or this apartment at that address. That's fine. That's called conventional analysis. But if I want to say, but where is, what's the actual location of Kim? Then that's not satisfied with just pointing out that's a table, that's a bodhisattva, that's a tree. But looking, where in the tree is the tree? Where in this body and mind complex is Kim? Where in her apartment is the inherently existent Kim? That's called ultimate analysis, when you're trying to search for what appears to your mind as an inherently existing location. The location exists conventionally and can be found through conventional analysis. I go to Raleigh, go down to your neighborhood, your street, look for your address, ring your doorbell, I'm there, right?
Yes, but what I'm saying is that I understand that, but that could be any address. In Buddhism, we are advised to go in the direction of being a Buddha, which means
right.
that from
Gate, Parigate.
Right, but what I don't understand is if my mind stream that goes from lifetime to lifetime is also not inherently existent, how does that vector continue towards Buddhahood? Does that make sense now?
I'm glad you explained it to me. I think the same thing. Conventionally existent mind stream can be found conventionally. You could, if you ask the Buddha, where is after, before Kim was born, say, where was the mind stream that eventually became Kim Lilig? Is that right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah. Or if when you die, eventually we all die, and we say, where's Kim's mind stream gone? The Buddha can say where it's gone. It's in this universe, or is reborn and as a god or a snail or a, what would you like to be? Butterfly? You can say conventionally, but if you try to look within that, you won't be able to find an inherently existent Kim. You might say, but still, you said you did agree, George, that there is a subtlemost mind and subtlemost wind that continues. And can I find Kim there? Well, even that's like looking deeper, 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 a real subtle little dot, right? Even that is just designated by mind, by name or concept. That does not inherently exist. That is an appearance to the mind. Say the Buddha's clairvoyance would be able to know what is on that mind stream, and the Buddha's perception would know the configuration of the prana. For instance, that when one becomes a Buddha, that prana becomes the substantial cause of the Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya, the bodies. It's like the body of our, you know, of our eternal mind stream.
If the mind stream is inherent...
No, the mind is not inherently existent.
That's what I'm saying. If it is not inherently existing, okay, then how does the progress that we've made, say, in this lifetime, listening to you and studying Dharma, that progress, how is that kept going in one direction if there's nothing inherently existent about it?
Because of the non-contradiction between the law of cause and effect and emptiness of inherent existence. Like in the Guru Puja, it says, please bless me to realize the actual intent of Nargarjuna's teaching that, let me read exactly for you. I usually know in Tibetan, but when I remember Geshe Jumpa Gyatso, sometimes he couldn't remember the verse, even though it's something you recite every day. He'd slap his head in his hand. So here. Korde rangshin du sam mebanang. Samsara and beyond samsara. Rangshin du sam mebanang have not even an atom of inherent existence. I mean, samsara and nirvana, you know, the mundane and the super mundane, there's not even an atom of inherent existence. And Gyude Tendel Lua Mepani, its corresponding pair, the infallible dependent arising of cause and effect. Those are two things. The fact that all phenomena are empty of an inherent existence. Anything in samsara and nirvana, there's not even an atom of inherent existence. Yet the law of cause and effect that arises in dependence on cause and effect is lua mepa, is infallible. The appearances that arise to our mind streams all arise because of karma, independence. Pensum gelme choksu chawai ludub gongdong tokpa jingilo. Grant me blessings to realize the intended meaning of Nargarjuna, Ludup is called Nargarjuna, which is that these two things, the fact that there's not even a mere atom, nothing of that's inherently existent in cyclic existence, yet the law of cause and effect is infallible, always arising, one thing leading to another, your mind stream one instant gives rise to the mind stream of the next instant. Those things are not that grant me blessing to realize Nargarjuna's intention is that they arise as mutually assisting one another without being mutually contradictory. Until we realize emptiness correctly, we'll always, when we have an understanding of emptiness, it seems like, how can things continue? How could the mind stream continue if it's empty of inherent existence? When we think about, oh, there's a real continuum, inherently existent continuum, we say, how could things be empty of inherent existence? When you have the correct view of emptiness, and maybe none of us do, maybe all of you do, I don't yet at all. When you have the correct view of emptiness, you see that the two are not in contradiction, but they're mutually supportive. The fact that things can evolve due to karma and arise in dependence on the causes, the effects can arise independent on the causes, is a result of them being not inherently existent. if the phenomena, because we, although we think now that maybe there's some things that are inherently existent, and couldn't that work? If phenomena were inherently existent, if they were not merely imputed by the mind, mm-hmm. they would not be able to change. Mm-hmm. Because inherent existence, if something were inherently existent, it would not be dependent on anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And therefore, it wouldn't be it wouldn't rely on causes or any kind of influence to change. It would be static and remaining. And you might think, okay, maybe permanent phenomena are inherently existent. But those permanent phenomena that do exist conventionally, like space, uncompounded space, emptiness and so forth, selflessness, the two cessations. Cessation itself is permanent. Once you achieve cessation of delusions, it doesn't change, remains ceased. If you achieve that cessation through analysis, you know, eliminating the delusions, those states, those permanent things also that do exist also are empty of inherent existence because they have parts. They depend on recognizing space, recognizing emptiness relies on something else. You don't have emptiness independent. There's the emptiness of the form, emptiness of the cup. You don't just have emptiness as an abstract concept. There's emptiness of emptiness. There's always emptiness of something, so it's dependent. So there is no contradiction between, this is the ultimate intention of Nargarjuna's thought, that although everything is non-inherently existent, there's no contradiction at all with the evolution of things due to dependent arising, karma. In fact, not only are they not contradictory, they mutually support one another.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'll definitely chew on it.
Yeah. So one place you can look is in Lama Tsongkhapa's three principal aspects of the path. 1 second, Stephanie, I'll call you. One of the verses there, a couple of the verses are talking about that, that when one has the correct view of emptiness, one no longer sees these two concepts as somehow contradictory. In fact, not only do they assist one another, but Lama Tsongkhapa's view is that one implies the other. So, yeah, that's, you can ask Geshe-la if he's ever talking about emptiness, you might ask him that question also. So, Stephanie, I think you had a question.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Yeah.
I apologize. I didn't mean to interrupt. I thought you were done. I would regret not asking this question, but I struggle when I'm in meditation, not with being distracted by thoughts or memories or anything like that, but sometimes I get these really strong physical sensations, warmth, tingling, and they get me all excited, like something is about to happen. You know, I'm about to see emptiness. I don't know what to do. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So I mentioned, I think it was one of my favorite stories with Lama Yeshe was at the beginning when I would meditate, I would feel one half of my body would be cold and the other half would be hot. And in the course of, you know, this is very uncomfortable. And then in the course, it would change. This side would become hot, this side would become cold and vice versa. And I went to Lama and I asked him, what does this mean? You know, is something wrong? Is this good, bad? Lama was sitting on a bed, you know, like a Western bed, which is kind of high and soft, unlike the Tibetan beds where they have a carpet where they can meditate. So he was laughing and laughing. He fell off the bed laughing. And he said, there are so many varieties of physical manifestations as you're meditating because the as you're meditating, you're doing things that you don't usually do in ordinary life. You're concentrating the winds. Like I mentioned, if you do a long Vajrasattva retreat, you concentrate too much, you can get kind of a pain at the heart due to the prana, the lung. And actually, there are many lungs. There are different kinds of lungs, different kinds of winds within our body. When people would come to Lama and say, oh, Lama, I've got lung. What can I do? Give me some medicine. Lama said, without lung, you'd be dead. Wind, prana is what moves your mind, what causes your body to exist, So if you have these pains, you might recognize that they are temporary. That can be some kind of solace, that there are a variety of things that can occur to the mind, different appearances due to karma, due to change in your body and so forth. And the problem with those things is that, say, for instance, you might think, oh, you saw Tara, then I give up the meditation I'm doing and just sort of watch this, what I think is Tara, or green light or sparks or something like this, that can become a distraction, especially if it's something that you are fascinated by. If it's something that's annoying, that's also to be a problem, because you're trying to keep away from that. One, and the ones that are attractive or pleasant, you're trying to keep along it, and you miss the meditation. So just be like Lama on the bed laughing, don't hurt yourself falling, and say, oh, wow, this is just one of those innumerable kinds of manifestations. It will pass.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure. So how are we doing? Satisfied? Oh. Naga.
Venerable George, could you tell us a little bit why you decided to become a monk?
Secret. No, I'm just joking. I think inspired by Lama Yeshe and Lama Sopa, the first course I went to 1974 at Kopan, and even late at night, their lights were on. If you went out to go to the toilet late at night, you could hear laughing out of Lama Zopa's room, at 4 a.m. And they were always happy. They were always calm. And they had, obviously the intention of other people was paramount rather than their own intention. Unlike the gurus at the time that, in India, had all these Rolls Royces and, so much wealth and everything. Lama Sopa's room is just bare. Lama Yeshe's room maybe it's a little nicer, but also very bare. I remember once at Tushita, in the cold, cold weather in Dharamsala, coming into Lama Yeshe's room, it was early in the morning. I think it was before we took precepts. And Lama had his Tibetan thing that maybe Geshe-la wears sometimes, that they would wear to the puja. It's kind of like a big coat you wear when you're sitting down. And he had a little teeny electric heater. The room was enormous. And it was like, not, and I said, Lama, don't you want some warmer heat? And he said, oh, this is enough. This is enough. They were, everything, there was nothing seeking other kinds of grandiose things. Everything was in the mind. And that inspired me. This is what I would like to be. That's one of the reasons I think that the Buddha enjoined the spiritual communities, whether it be the community of monks and nuns or the community of bodhisattvas, always one of the reasons for making certain of the rules that became vows was so that the laity would not lose respect. Now, one side, you might say it was self-serving, so the laity would still make offerings, right? Because they had respect for the side. But the real meaning was that with respect of holy beings, one thinks, I would like to be like that. So seeing Lama Yeshe and Lama Sopa Rinpoche, I thought, I would like to be like that. I think that was one of the factors. I remember going to Lama Zopa's room after the second course I attended, it must have been 1975, and said, you know, I've been thinking I might like to, I'm just kind of playing with the idea to become a monk. What do you think? And wasn't really asking permission, just sort of probing. And Lama Sopa apparently had been checking all of the people, you know, how he does divinations, maybe just with his own wisdom. He knew, he said, for you, it would be very good. So it's not necessarily in any one life, it's not necessarily the path that would be best for us. But in some lifetimes, you know, I won't mention any names, Robbie or Herb, it might be good to become monk. I won't mention any names, but then again, there are, you know, those that don't become monk or nun, Robbie or Herb, they should be like the great Bodhisattva Vimalakirti, who was a layman, you know, great Arya Bodhisattva, who was kind of an emanation of Manjushri, and even debated in Shariputra and the other disciples of the Buddha, and completely ran circles around them because of his wisdom and compassion and so forth. So it's one or the other, guys. You've got to become like Vimalakirti or become one day. I'm just joking. So anyway, that's in a nutshell my story. So we still have a couple minutes. Anyone else have something they need to get off their chest?
Venerable George, I've always had a question about the sutra, in that why is it that Shariputta addresses his question to Avalokiteshvara and not directly to the Buddha? You know, the format of this is very unusual, and I don't think there's any other sutra quite like that.
Well, I think there are some others, but I agree with you that it's not the norm. Generally, sometimes some situation will have occurred and the monks ask the Buddha, what was the karmic cause of this? And he will talk about past lives, or they'll have some question and they'll ask, or they'll ask Shariputra and Shariputra will ask the Buddha, and that's the actual sutra. But there are sutras where the main people who speak are inspired by the Buddha, and the Buddha doesn't have much to say. Here, the Buddha is in meditative equipoise up on Vulture's Peak. So like, say, for instance, if you were there, Vulture's Peak, the Dalai Lama is in meditative equipoise, and you want to ask a question, and Geshe Gelug is up there sitting, you know, a little ways away, kind of, he's meditating, but he's not in meditative equipoise. Who are you going to ask? Now you ask Geshe Gelug. You're not going to disturb the Dalai Lama. It's his deep concentration, right? I think a little bit like that. You know, because obviously at the very beginning, it says the Buddha was absorbed in this samadhi, very special samadhi that views all phenomena in their entirety and realizes them as empty and of inherent existence. Only the Buddhas can achieve that samadhi, because even the 10th level bodhisattvas, if they're meditating on emptiness, in emptiness there are no forms, no variety of phenomena can appear to them. Yet if they're in post-meditation, they don't have a direct realization of emptiness. They have a remembering consciousness of it. But so that's why Shariputra, maybe if the Buddha knew that, it's like Shariputra is coming to ask that question, the Buddha goes, ask. He knew that Shariputra would ask Avalokiteshvara. Anyway, that's my take on that.
Okay, thank you. Yes, that does clear it up some for me.
Okay. So we have accumulated, hopefully, some virtuous karma this weekend. We've tried to develop good motivation before listening. Even though my exposition is undoubtedly faulty in so many ways to count, still tried to explain the words of the Buddha, and at least I read to you, oh, I need to finish the lung of that. I read to you in the words of the Buddha, and so we've accumulated some merit. Before we do final dedication, let me just read the last section here of the Tibetan. Okay. So I think I mentioned name, nawame, name, che me, lu me, me. So there's in emptiness, there is no eye, no nose, no ear, no. So there is no there's no ignorance. There is no extinction of ignorance up to and including no aging and death and no extinction of aging and death. Dejendu, likewise, dugnelwa dang. Kunjungwa dang, gokpa dang, lame, yesheme, topa me, matopaye, matopayang medo. So likewise, there is no suffering, no origin, no cessation, no path, no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and no non-attainment. Sharipu, deta wena, jangshub sempa nam, topa mepe, Topa mepe chir, sherab gi paro tu chimpa la tene, tenshing nete. Sariputra, therefore, the bodhisattvas, because there is no attainment, the bodhisattvas depend, rely, and abide in the perfection of wisdom. Semla, dipa meching, dakme do, dakme te. The mind without obscuration and without fear. Jingi lokle shindu dene nyanen le depe tarjindo. They reach the end point of nirvana, having completely passed upon beyond all error. Dusundu nampa shupe sange tamche kyang sherab ki paro tu chimpala tene lana mepa yang dakpe lang yang dakpar zukpe jangshub du ngopa zukpa sange so. All the Buddhas of the three times also rely on the perfection of wisdom. Having relied on it, they achieve the unsurpassed, perfect enlightenment. Teta wena, sherab gi paro tu chimpe ngak, rikpa chimpo ngak, lana mepe ngak, minyampa dang nyampe ngak, dugnel tamche, raptu shiwa chepe ngak, mizumpe na, dempa shepa jate, sherab gi paro tu chimpe ngak meba, Tadyata, gate, gate, para gate, para sam gate, bodhi, svaha. So, therefore, the mantra of the great, of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the vidya, mahavidya mantra, the mantra of higher, the unsurpassed mantras, equal to the unsurpassed, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, the mantra that is true because it is not false, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom is proclaimed, tadyata gate gate para gate para sam gate bodhisvaha, or it is thus, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, bodhi, May it be thus. Jangchub Sempa, Sempa Chempo, Deta, Sherab Giparu to Chempa, Sabmula, Lapar Jao. So the last thing that Avalokiteshvara says is Sharipu, the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, should practice the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Dene, then, Dene Chomden De, Tingne Zinde, Le Shengde, Changchub Sempa, Sempa Chempo, Pakpa Chenrizi Wangchukla, Lexo Shejawa Jine, Lexo, Lexo, Rikibu, De, Deshin No, Rikibu, De, Deshin Te, Chita Kyoki Tempa, Deshin Shepa, Sherab Giparu Tu Chempa, Samula, Chepa Jate, Deshin Shepa Namkyang, Jesu Yirango. So then, the Bhagawan arose from that concentration and said to the Bodhisattva, Mahasattva, Arya Avalokiteshvara, he commended him saying, good, good, or well said, well said. Son of the lineage, it is like that. Son of the lineage, or Rikibu, it is like that. Just as you have explained, just as you have indicated the perfection of wisdom, the profound perfection of wisdom should be practiced. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. And then finally, Chomden Degi Deke Che Kaselne Sedan Dempa Sharitvati Budang Jangchub Sempa Sempa Chempo Pakpa Chenrizi Wangchub Dang Tamche dang dempe, kor dedak dang, ladang, midang, la mayindang, dise chepe, chikten yirang te, chomden deki, sungpa la ngompa dutu. So, how did we say in English? The Bhagavan having thus spoken, the Venerable Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara and those surrounding and in their entirety, along with the worlds of gods, humans, asuras, and Gandharvas, were overjoyed and highly praised what was spoken by the Bhagavan. Pakpa Sherab Giparu to Chimpe Ningpo Sokso. The Arya Sherab Giparu to Chimpa, the Arya Prajna Paramita Sutra Tridaya is complete. So, having created some merit this weekend, also a collection of wisdom, having understood a little bit maybe about emptiness, left some instincts in our minds as we hear further teachings to go further, let's dedicate those merits to the highest goal. Due to these merits, may I eventually achieve enlightenment out of a wish to be able to alleviate the suffering of all sentient beings and set them into the highest state of enlightenment itself. Due to these merits, and the collection of wisdom, may all the calamities that humans and animals and spirits and gods are experiencing at this time, confusion in this degenerate age, earthquakes, fires, heat waves, tsunamis, hurricanes, famine, confusion, anger, like at the period of the five degenerations when the delusions become rampant, sentient beings are the ones that were ready to make realizations, have already made those realizations. We are like the dregs at the bottom of the barrel. May all of these beings profit due to these merits. May all the confusion and chaos and anger be overcome. Due to these merits, may all these be pacified. this is our contribution. And then seal that conventional dedication or conventional dedications in the emptiness of the three spheres. The goals dedicated to even emptiness, even Buddhahood, enlightenment, is empty of inherent existence. Although it appears and it exists and functionally has an effect on the conventional level of cause and effect, it's empty of inherent existence. I myself, the dedicator, the agent, my mind, which is the instrument also of that dedication, is empty of inherent existence, are empty of inherent existence. And the process of dedication, the action of dedication itself, wishing strongly that these merits, which are not inherently existent, ripen in those results, which are not inherently existent, that dedication can't be found anywhere upon the parts. It's just a mental designation. It's empty of inherent existence. Even though I may have the feeling that I strongly wish, strongly dedicate the merits in these ways. And then relax and accept my thanks for bearing with. I think a good number of you have remained through the weekend. I heard there were a good number who were watching live on YouTube. So if you are live on YouTube and I don't see your faces, thank you for attending. Thank you for your perseverance. And there were apparently a good number of people who also watched the recordings on YouTube later. So that's nice. And I hope I have a chance to, it's no doubt we'll meet again. Karmically, the fact that we were all here together at the beginning was not just a random occurrence. It indicated that we'd created some karmic connection in past lives, if not earlier this lifetime. And who knows, the same group of people, maybe we'll all be together again in the future. We won't recognize each other as old friends, but maybe with the knowledge of Dharma, we'll say we must have created the cause. Some Bodhisattva with clairvoyance or Buddha will say, is that course at Kadampa Center in November 2020? You all created that collective karma. So thank you very much. Donna, I think you wanted to do some ceremony at the end, some ritual or something, right?
Yes, General George, we're so thankful to you for really this whole 2 weeks of wonderful, wonderful teachings, and we'd like to offer a mandala in thanks.
It sounded like Lawrence Welk. Wonderful, wonderful.
Okay. Saji Puki Chukshin Metok Tramri Rabling Shi Nite Kien Padi Sangge Chokshur Gepa. Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Nirya Chayami.
Thank you very much. That was very sweet. So may the bodhicitta merits, may the bodhicitta which has not yet arisen arise, and may the bodhicitta which has arisen as a result of these merits not decline but increase evermore. Chang Chub Sam Cho Grim Po Che Ma Ke Panam Ke Gyu Che Ke Panyam Pa Me Payam Gone Gong Tu Pelwa Sho. Thank you very much. See you, as Lama Yeshe used to say, see you in the sky.